Well, I hope that woke you up. That was a little bit of kicking and screaming by the Cloak and Dagger Dating Service out of Athens, Georgia. You can check out their Facebook page in the show notes if you like them. They are headed up by George Marston and his beautiful wife. George is a buddy of mine who I know from the Newsarama days. At any rate, welcome. This is another exciting episode of Panel Discussions, coming to you live from our glamorous Panel Discussion studios in sun-drenched Vestal, New York, where I get paid to work with no pants on. All right, this week we actually intended to look at a couple of the really underappreciated aspects of comic book art. We were going to look at both coloring and lettering and talk to a colorist and a letterer, a couple of buddies of mine. And here, I'll give you some context. Russ knew this going in, so we kind of didn't cover it, but this all really started for me when I was having a conversation with a woman who lived across the street from me at my old apartment. And I made some reference to a buddy of mine who was a letterer or a colorist. And she said, "That's a job?" And, you know, it didn't really occur to me until just then, but, like, people who don't read comics, people who aren't in this business or who aren't fans, don't understand that it isn't like the newspaper strips. You know, they don't understand that one guy doesn't basically take it from nothing into a finished product. Or if they do, you know, a lot of people will, you know, you'll say, "Oh, I work in comics," and they'll say, "Oh, do you write it or do you draw it?" So there is a kind of an awareness that there's a penciler and that there is a writer, but very much like the famous Chasing Amy scene that Russ references, or that Russ and I reference, where Banky is basically accused of tracing because as an anchor, the fan doesn't understand what it is he brings to the table. That's absolutely true for people who are anything except for the writer and the penciler. I think that average people don't even know that these are jobs. And even some of the fans, they don't really know what these guys bring to the table. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the job of lettering. And Russ, an old buddy of mine from my days at Wizard Magazine. I was an intern there and then a freelancer in like 99 to about 2001. And Russ was working in the web. I can't remember what his title is. He does say it at some point. but he was one of our graphic artists and a web guy at the time, and so he worked, you know, on the other side of a wall from me, and we used to go out to lunch along with Mel Kahlo, who now works at Arkea, and Lars Pearson, who used to do the price guide, and a bunch of other people pretty regularly. And so we got to be buddies back then, and in spite of having not spoken, like, you know, face-to-face or even on the phone, we really just used the internet to keep in touch intermittently for the last 12 years. We got on the phone and immediately just launched into, "Hey, what's going on?" as you'll kind of hear. And so I wanted to give a little bit more of a preface than I necessarily normally would to an interview for two reasons. First of all, because Russ and I, we just kind of took off and kept moving. And we talked about so many things that I thought were so fun and interesting that when I went back through and listened through it again, there was nothing I really wanted to cut very much. So rather than trying to take an hour and a half conversation and break it down to something like 45 minutes just to make it more manageable, I've decided that next week I'm going to talk to my friend the colorist, and this week is going to be all about Russ Wooten. It also is, it seems kind of oddly perfectly timed, because he and I had been trying for 6 or 8 weeks to line up our schedules to where we could get this done, and when we finally did, we do it, and then, wham! Rob Liefeld, who we talk about quite a bit, is just all over the news the last week or so. Even after the announcement of him taking over 3 titles of the New 52, you had, you know, he's had a couple of minor controversies. He has announced via Twitter, although nothing's official yet, that The Infinite appears to be stalled or over, which The Infinite is one of the books that Russ works on. We did record this about a week ago, so you'll hear Russ referencing The Infinite and how he works on that title, and I don't say anything at all about the potential for that book to be over, because that story had not even broken yet when we were talking. So at any rate, you know, like I said, thanks very much for listening again this week. We'll pretty much just be coming back out to wrap up once the interview's over, but wanted to give everyone a little bit of a preface so you knew exactly what was going on. Had we just started the interview right off the bat, I think it's 5-10 minutes in before I finally get a chance to slow things down and say, oh, by the way, this is who we are. So without further ado, Mr. Russ Wooten.
Oh, how are you, man? Pretty good. It's been quite some time since I actually heard your voice.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that today. I was thinking, geez, I think it's been almost 10 years since I saw you. When were you interning at Wizard?
I interned in 99, and then because I was driving to and from D.C. a lot, and so I would pass through Westchester, and I was doing some freelance work, I would occasionally stop in just to say hello to people.
Yeah.
In like 2000, 2001. But by like January or February of 2001, they stopped giving me freelance work, and I think that's the last time I actually saw or spoke to anybody besides Mike Cotton and Brian Cunningham, neither of whom I really dealt with when I was there all that much. So it's ironic that they're the only ones I talk to now.
Yeah. Well, they I left Wizard in, I think it was June 2001, so it was shortly after.
Yeah.
Yeah, after your last visit to Wizard, I was gone anyway. So.
Yeah, see, it's funny. I think that it was 2008 or something when it was shortly before I contacted you through Facebook that I noticed that you were a letterer. So did you go straight from Wizard into that, or did you
not straight into it, but it was not long after that. I had when I left Wizard, I was doing freelance web design, and that was most of what I was doing. Just kind of scraping by, and then I met Chris Eliopoulos while I was working at Wizard, because he was friends with Buddy Scalera, you know, the online editor there.
Yeah.
I was doing the assistant editor, web design stuff. And so I met him, the first time I met him I think was when we were doing a little article on him and his cartooning process, because he was working at the time, he was doing Desperate Times.
Yeah.
And that was originally published in Savage Dragon, and then he did it for a short time with Image. And then I think he self-published it through he and Buddy's alternative. I mean, well, I guess it was Buddy, you know, Buddy and Aaron Sanchez. What was the name of their publishing? And they're still doing it every once in a while. After Hours Press.
That's right, because I've got a couple of Buddy's, like, art books and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't remember who's publishing those, because he did. He first published some of the comic book resource stuff through After Hours Press, and then he was picked up. A publisher picked him up. A publisher that does art books and stuff picked him up, and has published I think three or four of his books now. So anyway, I was doing. That's when I met Chris in person, and then and I guess it was in 2002. Maybe mid-2002 or so, he contacted me to ask if I was interested in helping him out with some lettering stuff, because he had so much work with Marvel. It was, he was about to the point where he'd have to start turning work down. So I kind of, so he knew I was a designer. He knew my skill set and my abilities and whatever, and he was like, hey, you want to help out? I know you're doing the freelance thing, and, I could give you some work, and I could teach you how to letter. And then it was in early 03 when I want to say April or so. I think we officially started in, like, May or something like that, but where he put together virtual calligraphy to do a whole bunch of lettering for Marvel. So he picked, he took me on and other guys who were, they were house in house at Marvel doing lettering. Corey Petit and Randy Gentile. And so so that's how it happened. Kind of, I didn't fall right into it, but sort of transitioned over from Wizard. There was a short time where I wasn't doing, where I was doing mostly web stuff. Once I started doing the lettering stuff, I left the web design behind. I got sick of that.
Well, the comics industry is notoriously lucrative, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wish, right?
Well, why don't I, because I might pick up at any given point in that conversation, just to give people a primer, but why don't I introduce you?
Okay.
This is, I'm here with Russ Wooten, and Russ is the letterer for, the thing I always tell people is The Walking Dead, because everybody knows The Walking Dead. What else do you work on regularly? Because I've seen your name around, but that's the one that sticks with me.
Well, these days, I'm doing most all of the Skybound books for Robert Kirkman, Invincible, mm-hmm. Walking Dead, The Infinite, with his, you know, he and Rob Liefeld's book.
Yeah.
Super Dinosaur, which is a lot of fun. And then I'm also doing one that hasn't come out yet called Thief of Thieves. And let's see, what else am I lettering? Oh, well, I'm lettering the relatively new book written by Nate Cosby and Ben McCool called Pigs over at Image. And that's a
modern... It's a really cool book, actually.
Oh, good. You like it? Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's a Cold War era sleeper cell is sort of reactivated in modern times and, from Cuba. So
it kind of reminds me of, and this is one of those things that, one of those movies that only I liked because it's so ridiculously campy, but plot wise, not in terms of camp value, it reminds me a little bit of this Charles Bronson movie called Telephone.
I never saw that one.
It's the basic premise of it is that there's these people who've been hypnotized to really believe that they're, you know, American citizens, so that they can be the best possible sleeper cell because they don't, you know, they wouldn't be susceptible to like truth serum.
Right, right. They're
but
not.
Then you call them on the telephone and you give them this key phrase which is part of a Robert Frost poem, and suddenly they go off and start blowing stuff up.
That sounds actually kind of cool. If I go into it, watching it, knowing it's a kind of campy Charles Bronson.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of slick, you know.
And that's exactly it. Like the premise is great, and so every time there's a good, especially because of the fact that it's Cold War, and so it's the same like time frame.
Right.
Every time there's a good kind of like sleeper cell anything, that's the first thing I think of. It's like, you know, when I was like 15, I loved this movie that. May or may not hold up now that I'm not 15, but at the same time, the premise still just on the face of it is not bad.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, you know, that's a pretty good analogy for at least to at least get people in, you know, interested in Pigs.
I mean,
and it's pretty serious. You know, Nate Cosby is known for his all ages stuff because he was the all ages editor over at Marvel for a long time. And before I stopped doing Marvel stuff, for the most part, I was, I lettered Thor: The Mighty Avenger, which was an all ages book that he put together.
See, but I mostly know him from his Boom stuff, which is not nearly as, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I'm also lettering Joe Casey stuff. I'm sort of his de facto letterer. At least have been for a few years anyway, and doing Godland, which I think issue 35 just came out within the last couple of weeks. Officer Down, which was a one shot, we just had a hardcover edition of that come out. That was a lot of fun with Chris Burnham on the art. Those guys are a great team. They also did Nixon's Pals. It was a one shot graphic novel a few years back that I lettered. And then of course is Butcher Baker, The Righteous Man.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That's a hell of a lot of fun. I mean, that's definitely 180 degrees from, say, an all ages book like Super Dinosaur, but it's very much an adult book, but it's a hell of a lot of fun for a, you know, superhero book that's just kind of crazy, you know. So I do the lettering for the Gutters website. It's a web comic, you know, that's a sort of commentary on the comic book industry.
I think that's a favorite for like people who do exactly the kind of stuff I do. I write about comics all day, so the Gutters is one of those regular stops because you're sitting here going, you know, I'm one of the people who are like exactly in the target demographic for that.
And Ryan tries to keep topical. You know, he's literally writing these the strip. There's a strip every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and he's literally writing them like a day or so before, and you know, scrambling to get an artist to do it just so that they can be, you know, a timely thing, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, whether you like it or not, I think that's, you know, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of he takes a lot of jabs at everybody, but you know, it's good natured, and it's you know, it's just, you know, satire. And I think for the most part, most people, even the targets of some of his comics, take that into consideration.
Yeah, except for Garib, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. That was a little bit of a that was a dark day for the ex-Wizard publisher, I would say. But
yeah, you know, it's funny because that was one of those things that I only heard about even the existence of the strip after he ostensibly sent somebody a cease and desist letter and threatened this guy's job and all this other kind of stuff. And so it's one of those classic things of, like, if you just ignored it and let it die, then it'd be dead in 24 hours. But the fact that,
right,
like, the fact that you overreacted to it meant that people hear about it for weeks, like, through the grapevine.
Well, yeah, we must have got a lot of publicity out of that because, you know, we had a strip that's usually up for a couple of days, you know, got at least a couple of weeks probably worth of press out of it just because, you know, we redid the script.
Yeah.
Because the original artist asked us to pull it down, so asked Ryan to. So he did, you know, he did that, and he, Lard D'Souza, one of the other guys with Blind Ferret, who puts the comic together,
yeah,
he went and whipped up another one real quick. So, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I don't know.
And again, you don't want to necessarily try to make a snap judgment based on third-hand reports, but it was just one of those, like, when you think about, you know, like you know, the current one is a jab at Dynamite, but you kind of go out of your way to point out, or, you know, Ryan does, that, like, we know these guys, we like these guys, they get along with us, and that's generally how it works, is that almost everybody in the gutters just kind of takes their lumps by virtue of the fact that it's a small and incestuous industry, so, like, of course somebody's going to make a live old feet joke. You know?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that in the grand scheme of things, I think most people in the comic book business, you know, I think for the most part, you know, you can take a joke, you know, and
mm-hmm.
have a good sense of humor about yourself. And I think that's the key to life anyway, you know, and especially when you get in a place where you're kind of in the spotlight in such a small industry, you know, if you can't laugh at yourself and, you know, then maybe you need to take a look in the mirror. I don't know.
Because,
you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it's comic books, man. You know, it's like, this, you know, this, we're not solving world peace, you know? And, we're doing, that's not to diminish comic books. It's a great storytelling medium. And, I mean, you obviously, you know that, but it's like, you know, I just think that, you know, because you look at somebody like, you mentioned Rob Liefeld. And Rob Liefeld is like, you know, that guy has taken so many punches from, you know, fans and the comic book media and stuff. But you know, he takes it in stride and smiles and you know, he keeps drawing his ass off. And he keeps writing and he keeps creating and he does what he loves and he just goes on with it, and you know, so that's the kind of example people should look at, I think, you know, when it comes to, having a good sense of humor about yourself and then, you know, just enjoying what you do and try to do it well. So.
Yeah, the funny thing about Rob in particular, and he's the reason I kind of threw him out there as an example is because we've had this conversation before about how he's one of those guys who, like, you have to, like, punch him in the face in order to upset him. Because he really, like, to me, I remember when I was a kid, when I was shortly after Wizard, actually, I had done this comic strip in college where the artist who drew it really didn't like Rob. And so there was just a mountain of, like, Liefeld feet jokes. Because it was, again, it was kind of a self-referential making fun of trends in comics kind of thing.
Right.
And at one point, just for a laugh, I met him at a show, and along with a bunch of the actual, like, you know, X-Force kind of stuff, I got him one of those strips, and I said, could you sign this for my artist, because I want to send it to him. And Rob thought it was just, like, he read it, and he just told me, like, this is really funny, I like this, like, yeah, and he, like, wrote a little message on the thing for the guy, and he sit here and go, like, the guy's taking shots at you, but you have enough of a sense of humor about yourself to be able to just read the punchline and divorce yourself from it and say, like, hey, this is funny.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, it's like, you know, how many, any of us could look at any of, you know, go back and look at anything we've done with work or school or whatever, and you can look at stuff, and there's plenty of stuff people can make fun of, you know, so.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, I think Rob gets a lot of, you know, jabs unfairly, you know, I mean, you know, it's just, he's one of, I haven't met him in person, I've only talked to him through email, and, you know, I've done some work with him, you know, with Robert Kirkman and stuff, and, you know, he just seems like a hell of a nice guy, and he has a love for comics and enthusiasm for comics that some people, you know, and some big names in the industry don't. They just seem to, like, they almost seem to hate their jobs, you know, and they're too busy, you know, talking shit about the bad stuff instead of talking about what's cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's really exasperating is that, I mean, when you look at something like DC's initiative, they did so many things right with that initiative that I have a really hard time, and yes, you got to call a spade, and when something's not good, you just got to say, yeah, it's not to my liking. But, like, I find it so hard to believe that there are certain people who are just so fixated on, like, the handful of things that they did really wrong, because you sit here and go, you know, speaking for myself, I went from reading about 4 DC books a month to about 25. And so you just sit here and go, like, by what sane measure is that not a success?
Okay.
If I'm even remotely representative of, you know what I mean?
Well, the thing is, I hadn't actually bought a DC book in I don't know how long, and just because for whatever reason, you know, stuff wasn't interesting to me. And then when they did the reboot, there were several books. I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. I was buying, you know, the first month I was buying, I think I bought like at least 10 of the, you know, the number ones. And then after that, the ones that I dug, I picked up the, the number twos, and then on from there. So, I think that, maybe they didn't grab a lot of non-comic book readers, but I think they really expanded their audience, at least within the comic book fan base, and, you know, got some people interested that hadn't really paid much attention for a while, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that, I just think in general there's a little too much negativity in the comic media press. You know, there's like, I guess that's a redundant media press, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no.
You know, and it's like it's so easy to be cynical and talk about what you hate, but I'd rather hear more about, well, what are you excited about? What are people reading? What kind of books do you like? Blown away by with the artwork or the story or whatever, you know, let me know. I mean, I don't, because it's kind of like movie critics reviews. Like, I'll take a negative review, you know, and I'll take that and I'll, you know, take it into consideration when I'm thinking about a movie I want to see. But I'm more interested in the people who like it and why they like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I had that conversation with somebody the other day, actually, because I, you know, when you're a critic and you do get paid to review things, I took kind of a broad cross section of stuff, and I said something about Blue Beetle, how I it's just not for me anymore. The first few issues I thought were really terrific, and it's one of those books that the character used to be a very unique personality in comics, and they've really embraced he's Spider-Man for the new generation to the point where he's become kind of just a teen archetype.
Right.
And so I said in my review, I said, you know, for me, that doesn't work because I liked the fact that the character was so different and that the old book was so different. And so the new book just doesn't appeal to me. And a reader came in and was like, dude, you're going to kill the book in my comments thread. And I said, no, I really don't think a bad review, especially one that's fairly reasonable and, you know, I'm not calling it all kinds of awful names. I'm just saying it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
I really don't feel like a negative review sinks a book for the most part, because to me, at least as a reader, I read a negative review and I'm like, huh, oh, okay. But if I read a really positive review, it spurs me to action. I feel like negative reviews don't spur anybody much to action. You know, if you're reading a negative review and saying, well, I'm not going to buy that, it's probably because you 80% chance weren't going to buy it anyhow.
Right. It's not necessarily going to stop people from buying the book. I mean, negative reviews have never stopped me from picking up a book or going to see movies. So,
yeah.
You know. But then, you know, I like to look at it. One of my favorites, actually my favorite movie critic would be Roger Ebert. And, you know, whether I agree with him or not on his particular reviews, the thing I like about what he does is, like, sometimes he'll talk about how much he hates a movie, but then he'll go on to say, but you know what? If you like this, this, and this, you might like it. So,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's a way to have a negative review without saying this is shit and you should avoid it. I mean, you know, I guess there's a place for that too, but I think there's sort of a vibe, and maybe it's all part of the internet culture that it's so easy for people to just, you know, go and, you know, vomit whatever.
Yeah, throw grenades.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's a shame that more people aren't talking about, you know, what they love or what, you know. I'm seeing it more and more, though. I mean, it's starting to see more positivity. So I think that's, you know, I think that isn't just, you know, it's not going to be in this negative slump the whole, you know, for future, but I think that, you know, I just kind of, that's why I sort of tune out Twitter sometimes, and I sort of stay away from some of the review sites, just because, you know, and then you definitely stay away from the comment section. I mean, I guess if, you know, with your site, you have to sort of address the comments sometimes, but for the most part, I think I try to, you know, it's best to stay away from comments, because it's so easy for people to just, you know, oh, that sucks.
Oh, that's exactly, I mean, for example, there's one guy on our site who does a lot of, like, he covers all the speculation and rumors surrounding The Dark Knight, or The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, okay.
And so every time he does one of those little, oh, look, there's a Robin symbol in the background of the football scene, and he tries to speculate, does this actually mean there's a Robin there, or is it just a nice little drop-in, blah, 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 blah. There are two or three commenters, and they're usually the same guys, who seem to just exist to sit, watch stories, and then bitch about, like, why is this even a story? My God, you're so incompetent. And I'm just sitting here going, what? Like, why is it worth your time to post that? Like, I don't understand how the... But that's the nature of the internet, you're right. And I think that it's crept a little bit into not just reviews, but also just discourse about comics, because it's like, it's easier and it grabs more headlines if your review says, like, this is the worst comic of the last 10 years.
Right. Right. It always amazes me when people spend so much time and energy on something they hate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I hate a comic or I hate certain things, you know, it's one thing to talk in fun and, you know, poke fun at your buddies and stuff, or, oh my God, read that book. What is wrong with you, man? But then to spend so much time and energy, like, trying to spread that hatred of it, you know, something around, I mean, I just don't understand it. You know, I think that, I know it's sort of a human nature to sometimes get caught up in that. You sort of get caught up in the, you know, those internet flame wars or something like that.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. You know, I was talking to some other comic professionals, and, you know, and they brought up some similar things, and they said, you know, this was sometime last year, just, you know, they just said, you know, we're just trying to, you know, I think it'd be just be better overall if we all just try to focus on, you know, what the stuff we like and trying to promote stuff. And then it really, you know, and it made sense to me. I'm like, yeah, man, that's this, you know, because when I talk to, I have a good friend of mine, lives in New York, and I still talk to him every day, pretty much, through Instant Messenger. And, you know, most of the time, if we're talking comics, we're talking about oh man, did you see this? Did you see this art? Did you see this story? This is cool.
Yeah.
This, you know, and, you know, it's a much more fun conversation. And I'd much rather turn somebody on to something really cool than to try to stop them from buying something that I think is crap. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and ultimately that, like, that they enjoy is the other thing. Cause it's funny. I had this conversation not long ago about Wizard because, and, you know, from an objective standpoint, this was not a great book, but I enjoyed it as a teenager. I loved Guy Gardner Warrior. And, like, there was one particular guy who used to write, like, the Pellet Reviews and Wizard who just despised that book, but
yeah,
hated it so much that, like, he couldn't just let a month go by and not write a mean review of it.
Yeah.
It was just, like, it was a mission that, like, you know, you'd get 20 reviews a month out of, you know, 200 books that were being published. And somehow this one book, in spite of the fact that he thought it was awful, always got reviewed. And
yeah,
you just sit there and go, like, at what point are you just trying to, like, pick on the people who are left reading this book? Which,
yeah,
by the way, is probably 15% less because Wizard at that point had so much influence and you had this guy going after it every single month.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, and that's the thing is that, you know, Wizard gets a lot of – they got a lot of flack for their whole editorial style and stuff. But, you know, the thing is, all the criticism aside, and you know, whether valid or not,
right,
and we could talk about that all day, but the fact is, the guys that were putting Wizard together, and you know this from interning there, and I know this from working there, these guys loved comic books, you know, and they were excited about it, and they were, and that was, that's what they tried to get across. And, you know, they're, you know, of course, like you said, like the reviewer that did the constant negative on Guy Gardner, you know, that's one of those things where you sort of alienate your audience, you know, at that point, I think.
But I think you're right. I mean, I think the fact that, you know, I actually recently wrote a story about how Wizards kind of like almost was like a farm team for publishers in a way, because you sit here and go, you have Brian Cunningham is over at DC now. Mike is still doing basically Wizard all over again with his iPad magazine. You have, yeah, Champion, which I did a freelance piece for them this month. And then you have, you know, you have you working in lettering. You have Buddy.
Well,
and
Pat McCallum is over at DC as well.
Oh, so, yeah, that's right.
You know, former editor-in-chief. So, and
yeah,
then you've got the guys, Mike Fasolo, Tom Root, Doug Goldstein. You know, these guys over at Matt Sinreich, they,
yeah,
you know, they're doing Robot Chicken. I mean, that's huge.
It's
so
funny, actually. The first time I watched Robot Chicken, I didn't pick up on the fact that, you know, Matt was from The Office. And so I saw his name on the credits, and I was like, damn, that sounds familiar. And I, like, went to IMDb to look for him, and he didn't have an entry yet.
Yeah.
And so I was like, huh, I must be hallucinating. I don't know that name. And then,
yeah,
the same thing again 4 months later. I was like, damn, that guy's name really sounds familiar. That's the time I went to Google instead of IMDb. And as soon as I put his name into Google, I was like, shit, I remember that guy.
Yeah.
But,
well, that's the thing. You could go on. You said, like, Buddy Scalera is doing the resource books, you know, photo reference and stuff like that. And you just recently had a book about making comics from start to finish with some really big names interviewed in there. Besides Chris Eliopoulos, I mean, you know, Stan Lee, you know, is interviewed in there. So there's a bunch of other guys working in comics that have either worked at Wizard or have some sort of connection to Wizard. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a piece of comics history, whether people love it or hate it. And, you know, I met some great people through there, and I have some really good long-term friends lifetime friends, you know,
yeah,
there, and some really good people. So, you know,
well, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like very few things in life are as simple as people want them to be, you know.
And it's always easier to criticize and sort of look down on something when you really don't know much about it. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
When people always, would talk, you know, talk shit about Wizard. I just, you know, was just sort of, you know, just sort of, you know, go on and realize that I knew there was much more going on in that company and with the magazine than most realize. So, I mean, yeah, like you said, comics itself is sort of this small, infectious industry. I mean, you know, guys that worked at, worked at DC, you also worked at Marvel and vice versa.
Well, I mean, look at the editorial. I mean, right now, you know, editorially, DC has Bob Harris and Jim Lee in charge. And it really looks to me as though Rob is being kind of quietly inserted into an almost editorial position, because it looks like he's doing a lot of the kind of Abnett and Lanning style world building of, you know, they gave him these three titles, but these three titles are previously not connected. And now it sounds from the, you know, from the interview they did with Rob as though it's, they're almost creating kind of a cosmic universe among them. And so it really is kind of like, you know, just because somebody's in one place one day doesn't mean 10 years later you won't find them diametrically in the exact opposite position at the other company. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But look at Rob's, you know, he's got stuff going, you know, with not just with the Skybound, with the Infinite, but he's also, Extreme, is, a resurgence with Image Comics with some of the Extreme titles.
Yeah, they sold out Prophet number one today before it hit the stands tomorrow, so.
Yeah, so you know what? You know, people can badmouth him all they want, and the fact is, man, he gets people excited about comics, and he always has. So,
yeah,
that's something people need to keep in mind when they want to, you know, when they sort of want to look down their nose at him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, people that get people excited about comics, whether they're the kind of comics you want to read or not, it's good for all of us. It's good for the industry. I mean, we've got to get people excited again and keep the people excited that are into it, and then we got to get, you know, younger readers in, you know, that's why I love some of these new all ages books like Super Dinosaur and Nate Cosby and Chris Eliopoulos have a new one coming out called Cowboy that's being published by Archaea. So, you know, that's what we got to do. We got to get the kids reading because, you know, I don't know about you, but I started reading comics when I was a kid. So,
I mean, and one of the things that always drives me crazy is, like, a lot of my favorite books are indie books and creator-owned books, but the culture of kind of the indie and creator-owned guys looking down their nose at the mainstream, like, action and bombastic and superhero kind of stuff just drives me nuts because it's like, you know, I can't tell you the amount of money that I've spent on Terry Moore's books over the last 5 years, but or, you know, 10 years, but the only reason that happened was because when I was a kid – they killed off Superman, and I thought that was neat, you know?
Yeah.
And so, to me, it's kind of like very, very few people, when they're 25 years old, just decide, like, I'm going to pick up Sandman on a whim.
Well, exactly.
Most people come to the, you know, the mature reader's indie type of book by way of, like, you read Swamp Thing, and then that brings you to Constantine, and then Constantine brings you to Alan Moore and et cetera, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at, you know, we grow up reading superhero comics, but then as you get older, you realize, wait, there's a lot of other comics out there that have nothing to do with superheroes, you know, and it's, the more mature you get, and if you open your mind, there's some really great stuff out there, you know?
Yeah.
And then you've got guys like Rick Remender and Tony Moore, like, really kicking ass with some Marvel books, you know, and I mean, I can name so many guys that are doing these really killer superhero books, and these guys busted their humps in indie book, you know, in the indie world, and they created some great indie books, and they're going to create great indie books again.
Well, I mean, you got Tim Seeley over at, you know, Tim Seeley doing his thing at Top Cow right now, and you got, Ed Brubaker is a great example. You know, the first Brubaker book that I was ever really aware of, whether or not it was the first one I liked, but the first one that I committed his name to memory was Scene of the Crime. It was a little Vertigo miniseries he did like 15 years ago.
I don't think I'm familiar with that. I have to check that out.
It's out of print now, so it's like $30 to buy the paperback on Amazon. But I would venture as far as to say it's worth it.
Yeah.
But that one, it was like a private dick, you know, very kind of noirish, basically exactly the same kind of stuff that he does now with his creative work. But, you know, when you find a guy like that via his, like, awesome creator-owned stuff, and then, you know, he does 150 issues on Captain America, it's like you're going to crap on Captain America, just, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, that's again goes back to the all that negativity, and yeah. a lot of it's just bullshit that I don't really get. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I know I'm sure there are people who saw Rick Remender, what he's going to work on, X-Force. What the hell? He's going to write Venom?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but Rick's still doing some killer independent stuff. He's got you know, The Last Days of America of American Crime,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with him over the years as well, and a lot of his stuff is any stuff with Fear Agent, Last Days, Gigantic. I did a couple of fill-in issues on Strange Girl. You know, and these guys, yeah, I don't know, man. I think it's part of it is kind of exciting too, because I know that when I was doing a lot of Marvel stuff, when I was working with virtual calligraphy,
mm-hmm.
you know, I got to do a lot of cool mainstream superhero stuff, but at the same time, I was lettering, you know, these weird offbeat indie books, you know?
Yeah.
And,
well, I mean, like, for me, I found Last Days of American Crime because I interviewed Rick about his guest arc on Booster Gold.
Oh, okay.
And so comics are just so completely interconnected that I think anybody trying to say, like, well, my publisher is better than your publisher, or this genre doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, it's a silly kind of straw man argument, because you sit there and go, you can't make the generalization that all mainstream superheroes blow, because you have, you know, Morrison, who's an insane genius, and you have Remender, and you have Brubaker, and you have all these guys who by no objective measure could be considered anything less than excellent writers.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the thing, well, I remember something, I think it was an introduction or something that Kurt Busiek wrote years ago when it was in reference to Astro City. And I think he said something like, you know, all the great superhero stories have already been told, you know, there's no use in it. But of course he really meant just the opposite. He was, you know, and he went on to say, well, of course that's not true, because I'm doing Astro City, and I obviously believe there are still great superhero stories to be told. It's a genre, you know, that's one genre in comics, and no genre is limited to its bad creators. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't, it's like anything else. You could say, oh, I don't like horror books because, you know, look at this crappy horror book.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but let's talk to someone who likes horror, and I bet you they could show you 5 or 10, you know, incredible horror books that you would enjoy. You wouldn't even, you know, you wouldn't even think about horror. But look at the Walking Dead television show. So many people watch that show that talk to me, tell me, you know what, I don't even like zombie movies, but I love this show.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if those people had, you know, closed off their mind and said, well, I'm not into zombies, so I'm not even going to check out that show. Well, they're going to miss a lot. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people miss a lot of great stuff in comics because they're like, ah, I don't like superheroes, or I don't like horror, so I'm not going to read Hack Slash, or,
yeah,
you know, I don't like whatever it is. You know, they're going to miss so much great stuff out there. And that's a great thing about comics is, like, there's – it's unlimited in what you can do with the storytelling. You know, people, I think, outside of comics sort of see comics as this superhero genre, when in reality, comics is, you know, this medium that has, you know, stories for anyone. There's anyone at any age, any background is going to be able to find something in comics.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I do is
time, but,
sorry?
Again, it may be hard to find some, you know, more specialty.
Oh, yeah.
Some sort of niche audience, you know, for them to find their stuff, but it's out there somewhere, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that I tend to do a lot of the time is for any of the people who are on my Christmas list who, like, I don't know what I want to get them, I'll just pick some graphic novel that kind of fits that person, whether or not they actually read comics. Because it's this thing of, like, you know, what are the odds that, you know, my sister-in-law, who's never picked up a superhero comic and who doesn't, you know, who's not in the industry in the way that I am, like, what are the odds that she would have found Strangers in Paradise or Fables if I hadn't handed it to her? It's not right. That great. But but there's such a breadth to the content, especially even just from, you know, the top 10 publishers nowadays. I mean, once you go to the indie stuff, it's pretty much anything you could ever hope to find. But even just the top 5, top 10 publishers these days, there's so much breadth to what's out there that it's, you know... I mean, even when you think about it, even just a guy like Liefeld, it's like you take a guy who's had a career for 10, 20 years, and it's like, it's really hard to say I don't like Rob's work, because the breadth and variety of all the stuff that he's done over the course of a long career, you sit there and go, like, do you really think that there's very many people who have an open mind who can't say, like, oh yeah, I could find this, and this that I like?
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, I'm sure there are still people who think, oh, Rob Liefeld, yeah, Youngblood.
Mm-hmm.
He's got so many different things that, and even right now, he's got, you know, his hands on, you know, all these different genres. Look at The Infinite. I mean, we've got this science fiction time travel thing, you know, but he's still doing the exciting superhero stuff. And, you know, it's just, I think it's just a shame that when people, especially in comics, and, you know, themselves, who even make a living at it, sometimes can limit themselves or try to limit others by saying, oh, why is he doing that? Or why are they doing that? Well, because maybe he loves, you know, Spider-Man. He wants to work on Spider-Man once in his life. But, you know, the only time I question, like, what somebody's doing is kind of like, why aren't they doing some sort of creator-owned stuff? Why aren't they doing some sort of something different? Just because you see somebody that has so much talent and you think, man, what could they do if they went, you know, and did a book outside of Marvel and DC that, you know, they didn't have the limits of working in some sort of continuity and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, one of my closest friends in the business and one of my favorite creators is Dan Jurgens. And he's one of those guys who I, you know, for a long time I kind of wondered, like, why the hell doesn't he do, you know, something completely new? Because he has a lot of, you know, over the years he's had such a breadth and of different ideas, and he's worked with just about every major character. Like, at one point, I you have to say, like, haven't you pretty much done everything you want to do in, you know, mainstream comics, and don't you want to try something new? But when I asked him about that, he just kind of pointed at things, and he said, you know, for me personally, like, he says, I you know, I appreciate that, and I get why people want to do that, and I certainly would never stand in anybody's way. But for me personally, and he pointed out, you know, going back to the 80s, they, you know, DC stood behind him with Sun Devils, which was,
yeah.
And you know, you could rattle off, you know, something every 5-10 years that it's like, probably nobody would publish this if it were just a commercial thing, but this is something that I wanted to do, and the publisher has my back. And so it's kind of like, well, you know, even the question of, like, why the hell doesn't he do indie work? It's kind of like, I just, at some point, I kind of have come to the, well, he's probably got some reason going on, you know?
Well, exactly. I mean, look, he's got, with the example of Dan Jurgens, he just said he's got the company loyalty, you know, DC has been good to him, and, mm-hmm. and you know, when he wants to do something that's maybe out of the ordinary, they're interested in helping him do that. So, you know, it's one of those, it's like anything else. It's like, you know, people have got a million reasons why they're doing stuff. And people, you know, when I lettered a bunch of stuff from Marvel that, you know, some of the stuff I wasn't really into, that I wouldn't necessarily read. But, you know, if one thing, it pays the bills. Secondly, you're working with creators that, you may not be able to work with otherwise. And you're helping people to tell stories that, you know, some people are getting into it. I lettered a miniseries that was a manga-inspired miniseries about a girl from Marvel. It was called 15 Love. And it was about a teenage girl playing tennis, and she wanted to be a model, you know.
Yeah.
That's not a book I would pick up and read. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, there's a thing, there's an example of Marvel, you know, reaching out to an audience, maybe teenage girls or preteens, you know, or the tweens, whatever.
Yeah.
Young girls that they may not be interested in comics at all. You know, I remember my niece one time asking me when she was 12 or 13. She said, she's like, Uncle Russell, how come there aren't very many girl superheroes, you know? And so I sent her some, at the time I was lettering Aranya with Marvel. And that was it was a new Spider Girl.
I remember it.
Yeah. And she was Latina. So that, you know, and Aranya means spider in Spanish. So it was, and it was a fun book. And I thought, and so I sent her some copies of it because I said, you know, here's an example. You know, maybe she'll be into comics. Maybe she'll get into comics. Maybe she won't. You know, I know she liked the artwork, and I think mm-hmm. she told me she liked the stories. I don't know that it got her into reading comics, but, you know, there's an example where there's something out there, or there should be something out there for everybody. And, and there's also, and so there's reasons why, you know, people work on so many things. Sometimes it's just to pay the bills. Sometimes it's because they just want to expand their horizons, or sometimes it's because they're comfortable and they still, you know, they still get a rush out of, you know, writing Spider-Man or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, why don't I switch gears a little bit, because originally we were going to talk kind of about something specific, and what happened is I made that first Liefeld comment early on and we just took off. But, you know, I was going to ask you, because one of the things that I thought was really fascinating when I was talking to somebody recently was having this conversation about, and particularly it applies to, like, letterers and colorists,
right.
But this notion of, like, when people outside of comics hear what you do, is there kind of a sense of, like, wow, that's a job?
Yeah, sometimes there is. They're like, what? Oh, really? And they, a lot of times they kind of get it confused because they say, so you write the books? No, I don't write. I'm not writing those. I'm lettering it. You know, I take the script from the writer. And so, yeah, it often becomes a thing where I have to explain things. But I also feel like it's a good opportunity to sort of, what's the word for it? You know, to sort of promote comic books in general, you know?
Yeah, well, and the thing that I was going to say, too, is that, and I mean, coloring is also important to big mainstream books. But lettering for me, like when I'm walking around at a convention and I'm saying, hey, you know, I do reviews for Newsarama, do you wanna, you know, give me a comp copy and I'll make sure you get a write up. One of the things that immediately kind of alerts me to the seriousness with which people are kind of addressing their comic is the lettering.
Right.
Because I feel like somebody who scans the art and then goes through and types it in Times New Roman. Like the book just looks terrible. And it's not, pardon?
Comic Sans.
Yeah, exactly. And I really don't think that most people outside of comics would even think about that or consider that. But like, it's just such a kind of a jarring and a distracting thing on the page that, to me, like, a good letterer really can make the difference between something that I do and don't want to read, especially when it comes to indie stuff where the production value is not always that high.
Well, yeah, that's the thing is people don't realize a lot of times is that how important good lettering is to a comic book reading experience and to the professional look of the book. Because I remember even before I ever started learning the digital lettering with Chris Eliopoulos, you know, I did a little hand lettering, whatever, you know, pen and ink lettering on some comic strips I did in college and stuff like that. But, and I knew the process, but of the original, style of lettering, you know, with the, pen and ink on the boards. But anyway, I knew when I'd look at a book, you know, I'm like, oh, that lettering sucks, you know, or it would be hard. It would actually take me out of the story and it would take away from the experience. And I think that I've actually been called in to take over a lettering job where the book was otherwise very professional looking, say an indie book, right? But then the lettering just wasn't up to snuff. And they, you know, said, hey, Russ, can you come in here and letter this? We need a real pro look on this, you know? And,
yeah.
I'm sure that there are good letter, really good letters out there who know what I'm talking about, where they, you know, they kind of save a book from itself. In other words, you take it because it, you know, I've seen books where you have great story, great artwork, the story really flows, but then the lettering is just crap, and it's like, so it's just like hard to read, and it's frustrating to read. And I talked to a friend of mine who's an artist and writer, but he told me, he said, "Oh yeah, Russ," he said, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, he said, I even notice when the pointers look funny or they don't look right or whatever. So I think people don't realize, sometimes even in the industry, people don't realize that even the average reader notices these things, whether it clicks in their head, oh, this lettering sucks or not. Because I think sometimes people will put down a book because they're like, you know what, I don't know what it is, but I just don't like it. You know, and it might might just be the lettering. Maybe just the lettering just isn't, you know, it's not flowing. They have poor font choices or poor balloon style or whatever, or the lettering style clashes with the artwork or mm-hmm. doesn't fit the tone of the book. You know, I mean, any number of things. The coloring as well. I mean, I've seen coloring where the art is beautiful and then the coloring comes in and the colorist somehow just muddies it up, you know, and you just kind of cringe and go, oh, I wish, you know, so-and-so was coloring this or somebody else, just because it's, you know, because it just sort of like, you know, takes away that polish. And I think that's one of the things that lettering is sort of the polish in the end, you know, in the storytelling process, you know. So it's like you're taking the book and the story and you're making sure that it's slick and good to go, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, I've seen, and it's funny because, like, as a reviewer, these things that we're talking about that by and large only, like, real comic people can put their finger on, but a lot of people might notice in a kind of abstract layout kind of way.
Right.
These things are the kind of things where if I were to, like, write a review of an otherwise good book and say, like, I just really couldn't get into it because the colors were terrible or the lettering was bad or just, like, even just, like, something simple like the panel layout that, you know, could be anybody's fault.
Right.
You'll get comments on your review saying, like, how fucking picky are you that you're picking on the lettering? And I'm just like, but no, like, you don't understand. And that's a real, like, a comic page, when you look at that page, everything works in sync. And I think it's really, like, you really hit it on the head saying that, like, certain books, it could even be that the lettering is perfectly good, but if it's not, like, if it's not in the style of the artwork, it can be distracting.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, the best comics are, to use an old cliche, are when all the, you know, all the creators or all the pieces, if it's one creator, all of them are firing on all cylinders, you know. You've got, when everything is working in sync. And I've been fortunate to work with creators, writers, and artists who know the importance of good lettering, you know, and so they'll talk to me and say, hey, can we change this, or can we try it this way and maybe use something different for the sound effects, and you know, because these guys know that the lettering is an integral part of the story they want to tell, you know, like a guy like, well, Robert Kirkman, Rick Remender, Joe Casey, I mean, all these guys are like, you know, they have certain ideas about the lettering because they know what's going to work and they know what's working for their, you know, for this particular story. Sometimes, like, Joe Casey will come to me and say, hey, I've got a new book and I'd like you to work on it. And if you're interested, here's what I have in mind for the lettering. You know, I'm thinking this and this because of the, you know, he already has it in his head. If he's writing, he's picturing this, you know. He knows the artist, and he knows what the artist is putting down there, and he's sort of picturing what works. And sometimes I'll go, oh, yeah, you know, I wouldn't have thought about that, but that works perfectly for this, you know. I mean, that happened with Butcher Baker. You know, he and Mike Huddleston were already working on this book, and Joe came to me and asked if I wanted to do lettering, and I was, of course, down with it for sure. And he said, you know, I've got these ideas, and what if we do something similar we did on a previous book with this, you know, this font we used over here, but what if we use this balloon style and this? And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, that's perfect. And then and I had a couple other ideas I threw in there, and then, you know, hopefully it works. I think it works, but that's the thing. That's why it's always great to work with creators who really appreciate lettering and know the importance it is to a book. And I'm sure there are colorists out there that feel the same way, you know, guys who you know, have really worked hard to perfect their craft and, you know, they've got to appreciate it when, you know, somebody comes in and really knows how important that, you know, that coloring is to a book. So,
well, for me, it's a lot like costuming in a movie.
Yeah.
Where it's the kind of thing that a lot of the time people only notice it when it's really bad.
Right, right.
And so, like, that's, but to me, it's that it's so difficult to kind of explain to kind of an outside person, but, like, if you notice it when it's bad, then that means you're subconsciously noticing it when it's good, too. It's just that.
Right.
It's because it's working, you're not processing that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. It's like, I sort of lost my train of thought just now. I was listening to what you were saying, and I had that thought just went away. But it had something to do exactly with what you're talking about. It's like I guess it goes back to what we were talking about before. Like, well, I don't know what it is. Something bugs me about this, and you know, I know what it was. It was your movie analogy. You know, it's like art direction in the movie too. You know,
yeah.
Or set design. You know, there's a lot of. Whenever there's a, I don't know about you, but if you see a movie, say it takes place in the 80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when the set designers and the art directors are really on their game, you don't really notice necessarily, wait a second, why is that poster in the background for Duran Duran when that album didn't come out till 84 and this movie is taking place in 82 or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where... if they're doing their job and they know and they really know their stuff, you don't notice it because it just fits, you know. But then when they screw up, you know, and they get something that's or maybe it could just be as simple as poor color choices for the set, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And then it just is jarring, and it's the same kind of thing. It takes you out of the story, and anything that takes you out of the story that much is a big problem, especially in comic books. You know, you want people to get engrossed in it. You want them to not only what they're seeing on the page, but then the imagination in their head, you know?
I think it's interesting because people outside of the industry don't have the same sense for comics that they have for movies. Because, I mean, we're talking about all these kind of parallels, but, like, the average Joe on the street knows that there are set designers and wardrobe people and all this kind of stuff involved with the movie. And I'd be willing to bet that if you ask somebody who's not in comics, like, how many people do you think are involved in making Spider-Man, their answer would be less than five.
Yeah, and a lot of times they probably think it's one, you know, one person, like a one cartoonist, you know. And
yeah.
Because, they, you know, they unless they have been in read comics and stuff, then when they think comics, they mostly think of, you know, newspaper strips, which oftentimes are, you know, just one cartoonist.
And even if they're not, a lot of the time they're credited to just one cartoonist.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, they don't. They may not credit the colorist of the strip or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's why I look at when people ask me about it. Oftentimes, it depends on how long I think I'm going to be talking to them. You know, if it's if it's just in passing and I don't have time to explain everything, I may just explain. Oh, I'm a freelance graphic designer or graphic artist. Because I think digital lettering, that's the way I look at it, is it's a graphic art, graphic design gig, you know, whereas the old, you know, when they were, you know, when the guys do it with the pen and ink on the artboards and stuff, that's, to me, that's more of an art form, you know, that's a calligraphy, and, you know, that's more of an artistic pursuit or profession.
Right.
Whereas the digital stuff is more, graphic design. And although I think there's a lot of artistic ability, or what would you say, skill that comes into it, because I think the best letterers are also have an artistic background. If not fine art, if, you know, if not drawing, mm-hmm. whatever, then they have like a really strong graphic design background. So, you know, anyway, the so when I explain it, and I to someone who doesn't really know comics, I sort of see it as an opportunity, in a way, to be a small ambassador, you know. Because I think that maybe, you know, somebody has no idea about comic books when they find, you know, maybe when they hear that, oh, you mean there's a letter? That's a job? Like you said, like a colorist? That's a job? You really like color stuff for a living? And then maybe the next time they see a comic book in the bookstore or on the newsstand or something, they'll maybe they want to pick it up and look at, wait a second. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it almost goes back to the Chasing Amy thing of the inker.
Yeah. Where the uninformed says, oh, yeah, he's a tracer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, people who really know comics, or at least the artistic ones that know it, or especially the artists themselves, they know that a good inker is a good artist to begin with, you know. And he has to, like Banksy says in the movie, the art isn't finished until I'm done with it. I enhance it. I bring out the tone, the, you know,
yeah,
the page. And, I think the best inkers are the guy, you know, those guys that, they enhance what the penciler puts down there without like changing it completely, you know.
But there's a great,
and you look at, what's that?
I was just going to say, there was a great thing, in like the DC Letters page back in the 90s, that was about inkers and like what do they bring to the table. And yeah. I was at just the right age that it made a real impression on me because I hadn't really stopped to think about it before.
Yeah.
But it was like they had Dick Giordano and Doug Hazelwood and one other guy all ink this same image by Jim Aparo. And
different ways it came out.
Yeah, it's literally like just looking at the three static black and white images, and you sit there and go like, oh, so that makes the difference so clear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know that I'm an artist and come from an art background, and mm-hmm. But when it comes to comic book style stuff, I've never been real confident with my inking style, whether it's pen and ink or whether like more recently digital stuff. You know, it's one of those things I still struggle with. I'm much more comfortable penciling and maybe even doing shading and stuff. When it comes to putting the ink down, you know, I have so much respect for the guys who do it professionally and do it well, because, man, it's a whole other skill set that not everybody who can draw can paint. Not everybody who can paint could draw in pen and ink necessarily, or, you know, right. Or do it well. And, so yeah, man, I have much respect for those guys. But then again, you get a good guy, but you get a good inker, and I guarantee you they can draw. A really good inker could draw. You know, if you can look at his stuff, and maybe you've never seen any of his artwork other than his inking, but I guarantee you he's got a stack of stuff, whether people have seen it or not, and it's good. It's good. You know,
oh yeah, it's funny because I have a buddy, Norm Ratman, who did. You know, he inked Booster, now he's doing Teen Titans. And he's one of those guys who, like, I approached him at one point and I said, could you do a commission for me? Because I was binding a hardcover of Dan and Norm's whole Booster run.
Oh, wow.
And I did one for me and one for each of them. And so I was like, could you do a custom cover for this? Because we can surprise Dan, because I knew that the book was going to be ending. And so we were doing our final, like, exit interview for that book, and I told him, and here's what I'm going to do for you guys, you know. And Norm was – he's one of those guys who just tells you over and over again how bad he is and how he doesn't know what he's doing and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But the actual finished product is just spectacular. And so it's just one of those – you have these conversations with guys where it's like, I don't know where – like, I don't know what you're looking at other than, you know, because – He's a huge, huge fan of Ian Churchill's work because he's inked over him for years, and he's a big fan of Juergens' work. And I feel like the only logical explanation I can come up with for a guy like that saying, oh, man, I got no talent, is that he's looking at his pencils and he's trying to compare them to some other guy who he admires, and you can't – it's not apples to apples. You can't do that.
Well, yeah, exactly. Sometimes I think that it's like there's always going to be somebody who's like phenomenally better than you. So there's no, you know, you can't try to compare yourself is usually going to be hurtful, you know, to mm-hmm. your own style or your own artistic endeavors, because you're just going to go, how many times have you looked at stuff and you go, oh, well, maybe I just give up. I can't even imagine being that good. So what's the point, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, famously, one of the things I tell my friends is that as a writer in my career, I'll retire and die happy if I ever write anything as good as Jungle Land by Bruce Springsteen. But it's kind of a rhetorical statement because I don't write music. So there's you know, there's no way that I could, even if I wrote the Great American Novel from an objective standpoint, there's no way to compare the two things.
Right.
Now, one thing I did want to ask you before we wrap up, because I've had you for almost an hour here.
Wow.
I know, because we've been shooting the shit for a lot of it.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to specifically, just because I, once again, a conversation that I saw on a message board, and it's one of those things where you look and you're like, that guy's an idiot, but you can't exactly explain why he's an idiot, so you don't want to get involved with it.
Yeah.
But
sometimes it's pointless to explain even if you could, but yeah.
Well, here's my question, because this is something that somebody offered up on a message board. You know, that there's, you know, circulating this rumored new logo for DC Comics.
Right.
And they have their own proprietary font that they've invented for the letters on the font.
Oh, I didn't know that part, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's called, like, Gotham City or something. But so somebody had kind of said, you know, with the advent, with the rise of digital and with this idea that they want to bring in new readers from outside comics, right. Do you think that there's a chance that they would change from the kind of traditional, like, where even the fonts look handwritten if they're not, into something like this, just having your own proprietary font, and as long as it's clear, using that instead? And all I could think was, I guess it's theoretically plausible, but the odds are basically zero, because not just the history of it, but there's a lot of thought that goes into kind of the level of clarity and the level of kind of movement. And I feel like even if it was clear, something that looked very obviously like a computerized font would still look very static compared to moving figures. And do you think that's a fair kind of...
I think that's a valid assessment. I think because the thing is, and I think that's why all these years that we've been doing, you know, digital lettering, all the fonts are still based off of a hand lettered look, a pen and ink look, you know, because the people in the comic book business know. I mean, the editors know, the publishers know that if you just put a typeface on there, that was more of a mechanical look and more, you know, block letters or something like that. I think they know and that it's not going to look right, even to the person who doesn't really read comics, because even people who could never see themselves reading comic books have read newspaper comic strips, you know, and they know that comics have, you know, the lettering is, you know, somebody did that. It looks like somebody did that, you know, with a pen and ink. So yeah. I can't see that changing. I mean, I imagine somebody would, you know, may try that. I don't see DC trying that. I don't see Marvel trying that. I think that I think that's a leap that's a little bit too much to make as far as the, you know, lettering stuff goes. Because I think that's why that shitty, you know, MS Comic Sans font is so popular among people who know nothing about comics, or even people who try to do their own indie comics and think that that's a good comic book font, is because people like the look of this, of the lettering from comic strips. So they see something like Comic Sans, and you and I can look at it and go, oh man, that is like one of the worst typefaces ever, you know, for so many reasons. But they see it and they say, man, I like that because that looks like, you know, comic strip, you know, or a comic book or something. Because so even someone who knows nothing about comics, you know, they can know looking that there's something, there's a certain feel about that, that, that works, and the work is appealing. And also, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with what works with the artwork. Any kind of, for the most part, any kind of like a typeface or font that doesn't look like it was done with a pen and ink is almost always going to be jarring and look wrong with the artwork. I've seen it done in occasion with, you know, either captions or sometimes even dialogue. You know, when there's somebody's trying to do a certain look, you know, and sometimes it works. You look at Jonathan Hickman's The Nightly News with Image Comics.
Yeah.
He did some stuff with the lettering that, you know, I probably wouldn't have thought of, but it worked with his book because the whole look of his book, you know, Jonathan comes from a graphic design background, so he knows what's going to work. But
yeah, same thing with Anthony LaPay and Shooting War, which came out around the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, but as far as mainstream comics goes, you're not going to see any, and I just can't see any kind of a change from, you know, to typefaces that look more mechanical, like, you know, Helvetica or, you know, something that's more, you know, Verdana or whatever. You know, I think it's for the vast majority of it's going to be the pen and ink look. When even look at Marvel Comics a few years ago, when I first started lettering for Marvel in 2003 with Chris Eliopoulos' Virtual Calligraphy, at the time all the Marvel books were upper and lower case. And as you know, comics since the beginning of time, for the most part, have been written in all uppercase for the lettering. And so that was but that was an editorial decision. I think it was Bill Gemmis who started that. And anyway, but it didn't last because I think that for the most part, it didn't quite work. But now it does work on some books, and you know, some of the Ultimate books I think still use the upper and lower case. I've used upper and lower case on some books, depending on the font choice.
Mm-hmm.
It could work with that particular book. Or sometimes you use it for a caption or whatever, you know.
I also think that part of it is just, we were talking about kind of that ineffable thing, just looking at a page and knowing something's wrong. I feel like part of like the nature of lettering is just that it's so much a part of the language of comics. It's something that a lot of people, like I say, it's just part of the page as more than it's part of the image. And so people kind of take it for granted because, like, this is just the way it works in comics.
Well, yeah, and I think that even people that know nothing about comics, they know because it's such a part of pop culture.
Yeah.
That comics are done that way, because if you look at an advertisement that's trying to look like a comic book, they know to, you know, use this the fonts that look like hand lettering, or, you know, and that they know to do it all in uppercase for the most part.
Yeah, they pretty much know that everything has to be colored to look like Laura Allred.
Right. You know, so it's like there is sort of a language of comic books that is ingrained in our pop culture that people may not even be aware of, but it's there. And that's why they know when they look and they go, well, something's wrong with that, you know, when it's not working. And I think sometimes people don't, you know, people look at, I don't know if you've ever seen it with a, one of the, you know, a letterer's pet peeve is when someone puts an uppercase I in the middle of a word with the serifs, you know, the bar on the top and the bottom, instead of just a straight up and down line, which is supposed to be saved just for the personal pronoun. But you'll see that a lot of times in an advertisement where someone's trying to do the comic book look, and it's like, oh my God, why did they do that? But I honestly think that there are people, you know, people who know nothing about comics are going to look at that advertisement, and because the whoever was designing it didn't do their homework, they're going to look at that advertisement and go, something's wrong with that. So there's going to be something that doesn't sit right with them, whether they acknowledge it or understand it or not. It's not going to quite work, you know, because of the spacing of the letters or something.
Well, it's kind of like that thing of a lot of people don't notice that when you pluralize something and you put an apostrophe in front of the S.
Right.
And it's like a lot of people wouldn't notice that that's wrong, but the word looks wrong because of the fact that that's done incorrectly.
Right. Well, it's one of those things where This goes back to some of the editing stuff, and you know, goes into the copy editing and stuff, which is a lot of letterers do. You know, just it's just part of the gig. You know, you copy edit a lot while you're working. You know, with punctuation, yeah. Spelling, and stuff. But I'm sure you've noticed it as a writer. You look and say, "What is wrong with this? This book's wrong." And then you finally realize, "Oh, that's spelled wrong."
Yeah.
Something like that. And it's just one of those things, like, something is wrong with this, but I can't figure
it
out.
Yeah, recently a publisher sent me, because I was doing a story on their kind of whole publishing line. And so they sent me a handful of not only some finished PDFs to review, but also some scripts to look at. And I got that so much. I'm sitting here kind of leafing through the scripts going, like, man, it's a good thing that there's editors and artists and letterers along the way, because I'm sitting here going, like, this writer who is a fairly, like, he's an intelligent guy, he's a literate guy, and his books are good, but his spelling's shit.
yeah, well, that's what spell checks for, right?
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you just, once again, you kind of take for granted that, like, somebody along the way has to catch stuff like that. And
Yeah. Well, it's either a copy editor or it's with lettering. With comic books, often it's the letterer being a copy editor, and then the proofreaders and the editors taking a look at it afterwards and saying, you know, and catching whatever the letter is missed. Because invariably, I'm going to miss stuff because I'm so busy trying to do the lettering that the copy editing is sort of not top priority, but at the same time, I try to catch it as I'm going because I'm going to eventually have to change it anyway when somebody else catches it.
Yeah. Well, and when you're one of the last folks to touch the page, you don't want to be the guy who's holding things up because you come up with something. A worst case scenario comes to be something like that Morning Glories trade, where it's like somebody in post production forgot to put the lettering back on the page after it was already produced, published, and then reprinted.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah, they had a big hardcover that was like one of Image's big, like, you want this for Christmas type of items.
Right.
And it came out like December 10th or something, and they had to hurry it back to press and get it back out again for December 24th or whatever it was, because they had, I think it was two pages, it was like two facing pages, that when they upgraded it from the trade paperback to the larger format hardcover, that they weren't relettered, or the layout person just didn't put like the layer for the lettering back on it.
Right.
And you're sitting here going, like, that poor layout guy, you're sitting here going, that's your worst nightmare. Like, you're the last guy who touches the book, you make the mistake, and it's a huge public embarrassment for everybody involved.
Yeah. Oh, that happened to me before. Not with a hardcover, fortunately, but with a Fantastic Four book I had, because for a while now, you know, virtual calligraphy guys have been doing a lot of the production on the books they letter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the letterer and the production artist. And so I had I was lettering Fantastic Four for, I want to say, 5 years. I don't know exactly how many years, but it's the longest book I've been on other than Invincible.
Mm-hmm.
and The Walking Dead. But so this was a few years ago, and Chris Eliopoulos sent me an instant message. He goes, dude, what happened with this Fantastic Four? I'm like, what are you talking about? So, and he said, the last page, and he showed me a screenshot of the, you know, a scan of the last page, and the lettering was all, like, shifted off the page almost completely.
Hey.
And it was like, and it was also somehow enlarged or something, and I was like, what? And I couldn't believe that. I literally thought that it was just something happened in between
the printer.
I touched it and then it went to the printer. Something happened in that process that somehow that lettering layer got screwed up. I couldn't fathom what was my fault. But it turned out, I look at my original file and, you know, the InDesign file. Sure enough, somehow when I had, what I had done is done a last minute change to a page. And, you know, I mean, when I talk last minute, I mean, like, you know, changing stuff minutes before it goes to the printer, or that very day, you know?
Right.
And so I had done some last-minute change, and it was on, like, I think it was the last page of the book, or, you know, which makes it even worse, or one of the last pages. And somehow when I did that last-minute change and then saved it, for some reason, in Illustrator, for some reason, the way InDesign read that file after it changed, InDesign, like, kind of screwed it up, you know, just made it big and all wonky, right?
Yeah.
And somehow I didn't catch that. I didn't catch it, and then the editor didn't catch it before we approved it for the printer. And, so I was like, oh, my God. I was sick to my stomach, and it was one of those things where, it's out there in print. They actually put the page, the correct page, up on the web for people who bought the book and, wanted to read that page. And then we corrected it for the trade paperback collection, but, it's just one of those things that I felt like, oh, man, I felt like I let the editors down, I let Marvel down, I let Chris Eliopoulos down, because basically, he's the one who got me the work in the first place,
Yeah.
I let the readers down because,
Was this early in your run, or was this...
No, that's the bad thing is I'd actually been lettering for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years at that point. So it was a rookie mistake that I did when I wasn't a rookie. I had enough experience to know better. It was one of those things where, it just happens. It's like you said with the Morning Glories. Who knows? The production guys, whoever's the last person to work on the book, most of the time they are working under the gun, under crazy deadlines. And stuff's gonna happen, and I can empathize with them, So. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, well, in that case too, it was probably solicited and I missed it, but it didn't start getting promoted by Image until about 3 weeks before it hit the stands. I got the first real press release about it 3 weeks before. So you're sitting here going, it wouldn't surprise me if the final order cutoff that day hit and suddenly they had to triple their print run. Especially with a small – because Morning Glories, ultimately, it's a huge success, but it's a pretty small print-run book.
Right.
So you sit here and go, if suddenly, 500 people want that hardcover, that's probably a good chunk of the print run that you're going to do over again.
Yeah. But, and of course, when it's a smaller – when it's something like Image and a smaller publisher or they have smaller print runs for each of their books, it's worse because they end up paying, it costs more, it's going to cost a lot more money, and then it cuts into the creator's bottom line. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had times where I've done, where we've missed, missed something like a misspelling or an apostrophe here or there.
Or like a pointer going to the wrong person or something.
Yeah, and then you catch it later and you go, oh, you know what, we got to correct this for the trade. And, that sucks, but... at least you sort of feel like, well, at least now we can, for the trade, at least it'll be perfect, But it amazes me sometimes how, as much as we go over this stuff and check and double check and triple check and have several people looking at it, every once in a while something's gonna slip by, like a misspelling or a typo or something here or there, and it's actually sometimes it surprises me it doesn't happen more often in comics in general, just because, especially in mainstream with Marvel and DC, because there's such a rush to get those books out. You talk to the guys who work for Virtual Calligraphy or anybody that does Marvel stuff. I just finished a miniseries that Joe Casey wrote, and Nick Jugutta, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, was the illustrator on that, and so, I did, it was a 6-issue series, but then, for those 6 months, I was sort of reliving my Virtual Calligraphy days, once a month, because on Fridays, man, it gets tough. Those guys like Joe and the two Joes and Corey and Clayton over there and Chris Eliopoulos, man, they really worked their asses off on Friday nights trying to get all those books out. And anybody else who does the lettering, they're like, well, you said you started this whole thing that you wanted to talk about. You wanted to talk to letterer and colorists about, their role in it. And letterers and colorists, they feel the brunt of those deadlines the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you have, if the penciler and the inker get behind, then the colorist has to try to make it up on his end or her end. And if they can't do it, then the letterer's got to try to make up as much time as they can. So... yeah, colorists and letterers, even more so than inkers, I think, have their sort of the unsung grunt work, I don't want to say heroes, but, you know, the unsung, sort of the unsung soldiers, you know, but in the comic business, especially with Marvel and DC.
All right, so that was that. Once again, thanks very much for listening this week. I'm going to cut out a little bit early because it was a little bit on the long side, and I do want to try and keep our file sizes down, put less pressure on our servers and on those of you who are listening. But like I said, check back in next Monday around the same time, and I'll have another conversation with you. I cannot tell you the person's name yet because I haven't 100% confirmed it, so I might end up having to change at the last minute. You'll know. Because if it's not the same guy, I won't introduce him as my buddy, because I think I only know one guy who's a professional colorist who I'm friends with.